Welcome to the Let Good Things In show. I'm your host, Amanda Acker. I am so happy you are here. At the Let Good Things In show, we talk all about second chances, resiliency, following your intuition, and even music. Listen to hear stories of hope and to be inspired. Remember, you are stronger than you think. Let's dive in. Hi, my amazing humans. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the show. As always, I'm so excited to be bringing you my guest today. But before we get into the episode, I just want to remind you that I would absolutely love to hear from you. Send me an email and let me know what you think of today's episode. Amanda@amandaacker.com. Acker is spelled A-C-K-E-R. On today's episode, I had the pleasure of having a conversation with David Marion. David is the life recovery coach. On the episode, he shares his story of life before incarceration, during, and after, and what led him to become a life recovery coach and interventionalist. He's also made documentaries around drug addiction. He is truly an amazing human. And even better, next week we'll be having David back on the show along with his ex-wife to talk about how everything affected their relationship and how now they're able to work together as business partners in their life recovery coaching business. So without further ado, let's dive in. Hi, David. Welcome to the show. So happy to have you here.
Thanks, Amanda. It's really good to be here.
So just to start things off, could you just tell us, you know, what led to your incarceration? Like, what was your life like before you were incarcerated?
That's a good question. My life was pretty good. Life was great. I was successful. I owned my own gold and silver brokerage firm. I probably had 80 to 100 employees working for me.
Wow.
I'd say half of them were in recovery. The other half needed recovery. And everything was about the outside. You know, I wasn't really, I was dying on the inside, I said, but everything looked good on the outside.
So were you using drugs before you were incarcerated?
Yes, I was. So my story is I grew up in New York, worked on Wall Street for many years. And 1989, September 1st, they did an intervention on me.
Oh, boy.
They said, I'm doing too much cocaine and eating too many Quaaludes and drinking too much beer or whiskey. And I said, no, you guys aren't drinking enough. And they sent me out on a one-way ticket to St. Paul, Minnesota, to go to Hazleton, to go to a treatment center. And I went there for 30 days and stayed for 30 years. And
wow.
That's where my life really transformed. I was sober probably 12 or 13 years. I was active in recovery, doing some amazing things. Got married, had two kids, and I had a bunch of knee surgeries. And I was a first-generation opioid guy, prescription pill. I'll never forget the first time I went to the doctor, he wrote me a script for 180 pills.
How?
And I took two of them, and I'm like, whoa, the recall. You know, I felt like I was back at Studio 54 in the 87, the time of my life. And I called the doctor immediately, and I said, Doc, you're never going to believe it. He said, what's that? I said, I'm going to the bathroom. I opened up the pill bottle. They all spilled down. And he said, David, I'll write you another prescription. That's how fast it was.
Wow.
That immediate euphoria recall that I wanted more of this. And that began a run of about 4 or 5 years. And eventually I crashed and burned.
Now, was it Oxycontin that you were prescribed?
Yep. It was Oxycontin.
Yeah. That, you know, I watched, there's a series on, I think it's Prime or Hulu, one of the two. It's called Dope Sick. And yeah, it was ridiculous. Like I didn't like, you know, when I remember Oxycontin in the late 90s, early 2000s, but I didn't know the story behind it. And wow, what a twisted story that is. And, you know,
it's so real. You know, there's another one, the pharmacist, who is a friend of mine, also Dan down in New Orleans. You know, his son overdosed and died, and he started the whole investigation. It's another great series. But when you live this life, and, you know, I was doing so many oxys at one time, it was insane, probably 700-800 milligrams a day. I was buying them, you know, getting them from the doctors. And then I had nurses that were robbing hospitals, and I'd go to Vegas all the time. And I had guys out there that were cleaning out pharmacies. And I do whatever I could to get my pills. And then one day I ran out and my body was in the worst pain it's ever been. Mm. And when you're trying to kick this or withdrawing from it, it's almost as if somebody is inside of you cutting themselves out with a butter knife.
Oh, geez.
The pain is the worst pain to ever. So a guy came over, I had been separated at the time, and a guy came to my condo and he says, I could help you. He laid out a line. He said, don't ask any questions. Now I'm hooked on heroin. That began another run for about a year and a half because oxys really are synthetic heroin.
Yeah.
And now I got the real thing and it's like, I'm off to the races.
Wow. So in those, you know, in that part of your journey, you know, what was your home life like? Like, I know you mentioned that you were separated. So like what, you know, where were your kids in all of this? Did you have your kids already?
Yeah, I had my kids. They were probably 7 and 9 at the time. I was living at a, probably 20 minutes from them in a penthouse apartment that was just insane. Parties every night, you know, just loving life, I thought. And, you know, I was just digging that hole deeper and deeper.
Wow. And then, so what got you incarcerated? What happened to get you to that?
We were doing a public offering with my company. Hired a couple of guys from a big brokerage firm to come over and do this public offering. There was a bunch of problems that went on. One of the guys stole a lot of money. Long story short, they started an investigation and I was convicted of money laundering and conspiracy to commit wire fraud.
Oh, wow. And how long were you in, did you go to state prison? Did you go to federal prison? Like, where were you at?
I was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison.
And tell me about that. Like, what was federal prison like for you?
Oh, it was fabulous. It was just amazing.
No, yeah, I'm sure. It was a vacation, right?
So never having more than a speeding ticket in my life, right? Now I'm off to federal prison. And, you know, I just kind of had the attitude, I'm just going to get through this, you know, I'm going to do what I have to do. I remember the first day I'm coming in and they put you in the shoe, the hole for a while. Because they can't really attend to you because they have so many other things to do. The correctional officers, they're so busy.
So what?
They left me in there for a while. And during the strip search, one of the correction officers says, oh, by the way, your bunkie's going to be one of the highest ranking gang members in Chicago. He's on the chairman of the board of this big gang. And he's kind of laughing, you know. It's funny, a white guy's going to be in there, the black guy, going on and on. And I remember I walked into my, finally he took me over hours and hours later. And I walked in and I saw this guy in my room and I looked over and this guy, you know, telling me what a tough guy he is. And he's tatted up, missing a tooth, and he's on the floor praying.
Oh, wow.
And sure enough, he stands up, turns around, and sticks his hand out and says, hot rod. And my first response was, cool Dave. Do we all need nicknames in here? And, you know, I got to know this guy. We come from two different walks of life. You know, I grew up on the East Coast. He grew up in the inner city of Chicago into a life that I never imagined, you know, dealing drugs, gangs, things like that. Mine was more of a white collar side of this, you know. And I really did get to know him. He was semi-illiterate, taught him how to read and write. And we just got along great. He used to say, man, this dude is the white Morgan Freeman.
That's a great compliment. I love that.
I was the only white guy allowed in the black TV room to watch sports, you know?
Wow.
And I was one of 4 inmates out of 1,000 that got to leave the institution to go speak at business ethic conferences and colleges and universities. And they'd always say, Marion, you could take a few guys. You know, and who would I take? I'd take Hot Rod and a couple other guys from Chicago. And he really enjoyed it. He wanted to become a public speaker. And we kept perfecting this and doing different opportunities. And years ago, we got out and he went back to the city of Chicago. And he started doing something. The city of Chicago hired guys to do violence prevention.
Nice.
Going back into the streets, talking to a lot of these gang guys. And, you know, the message is real similar to mine in recovery. That if you don't want to keep living the way you're living and feeling the way you're feeling, there's another way, right? A message of hope. So we got really good at it about a year and a half, 2 years ago. My phone lights up and there's a video coming in. And I'm watching this. Hot Rod is speaking to a packed house on violence prevention at Princeton University.
Oh my gosh. That just gave me goosebumps. That's amazing.
He called me after. We're just crying. We're just laughing. It was just such a wonderful experience. So, you know, I always say we look for the opportunities in places we never expect, and we're going to find them.
Yeah.
You know, we have to be mindful and aware.
Yeah, that's very true.
You can just look at this thing and manifest the negativity. Oh, this sucks. I got to do this time. Blah, blah, blah. I made the, you know, you can do your time. Your time could do you, you know, and I did my time the way I wanted to do it.
Now, were you in for the full 5 years, did you say? Were you there the whole time?
No, I ended up doing 42 months, 11 days, 7 hours, and 6 minutes.
Jeez. You know that. How did you get out early?
Well, you get off good time, and I did this residential drug and alcohol program, which is a 9-month mental boot camp. That basically, if you get through that, you get a year off your sentence. And so I ended up doing that as well.
Nice.
But it was just, 150 guys live in a separate unit. And you program pretty much all morning. And then this, you know, it's constantly being aware of your surroundings and being responsible and accountable. And there's groups and there's meetings. And, you know, it's about the kind of reforming your criminal life and drug life.
Well, that's great that you had that opportunity to take part in something like that while you're incarcerated. I don't think, you know, a lot of people may not have that opportunity to do something like that. And, you know, as I think a lot of it has to do with holding yourself accountable too. You know, when you go to jail, prison, whatever it is, like a lot of times, I know for me and others, like you, your first reaction is it's not my fault. Like this person made me do it, or if I didn't do it, this was going to happen, or whatever excuse you can come up with. But it's taking responsibility for it, you know, taking the steps to recover while you're down, because yeah, you're in jail, but like you said, like why not make it something good to help better yourself and participate in these programs that do exist in some prisons, which is great.
Yeah, prison is strictly about punitive damages. There's no rehabilitation. The only rehabilitation comes from within.
Yeah.
You know, if you're really willing to do and, you know, an introspective, hard look at yourself and see, okay, this is where I'm at and this is where I want to be, right? It's really hard to get to where you're going unless you know where you're at. Mm. So you begin to understand. And let me tell you, there's a lot of people in prison who are innocent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people say they're innocent.
Oh, yeah. So, I didn't do it.
Admit, you know, that, hey, I made a mistake. Big difference between guilt and shame, right? Mm-hmm. Guilt is I made a mistake, but I could change. Shame is I am a mistake. I'm hopeless. And when you're feeling you live in that hopeless persona for a long time, that's just really tough. Prison, going into prison wasn't as hard as coming out.
So tell me about that. What was it like coming out?
You know, it's trying to redefine yourself. My story was a big story. It was blasted on the front page of newspapers where I lived. And, you know, I just came out and feeling like there was complete loneliness, isolation, having had so much financially, socially, you know, at one time and losing it all. I lost everything. And trying to find a job. I remember I came out and I went to an LA Fitness and I said, hey, I talked to one of the general managers that, listen, here's my story. I just came out and this is what I'm looking to do. I just want to clean toilets, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, do you have a resume? And I'm like, yeah. So I hand him a resume and he looks at my resume and he talks to another one of the managers there. And then they said, well, the district manager's in town. He'd like to talk to you. So long story short, I go talk with him and he sees my resume and he's like, we want to hire you as a general manager of one of our stores.
Wow.
Bro, I just want to clean toilets. And so he says, no, we want to. So I said, okay. I went back to my probation officer and he said, nope, sorry. You can't have anything to do with any type of fiduciary responsibility when you've been connected when you've been convicted of any type of financial crime.
Oh.
Well, I got offered a job as a sales manager of a company. They turned that down. Finally, I just said the hell with it. You know, I took a job at Goodwill, paying $10 an hour, which is close to my home. And if I did a good job, they were going to help me get my forklift license in there.
Wow.
10-cent raise to do that.
Nice. 10 cents. That goes a long way these days, right?
Yeah. Well, it was amazing. I saw people there. There was a woman there that was there 7 or 8 years.
Wow.
And, you know, I had tax returns over 7 figures for many years.
Ooh.
So now I'm getting smashed and I'm starting really from the bottom. And this woman was there 7 years and I had been there probably 3-4 weeks. And she says, I'm going in for my raise. And I said, oh, well, good luck. And she comes back. How'd it go? She goes, great. I got my raise. 10 cents an hour more. I said, come here. Let me just give you a hug. I mean, you know. It was the saddest thing I've ever witnessed. And they work you nonstop.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the low-paying jobs do. And, you know, when you get out of prison and you have a felony record especially, like, it's really hard to find a job that isn't like that. You know, because a lot of places that pay decent money, they don't want to give a job to someone with a criminal record. And it's really shitty because when you're in jail and you get out, it's okay, like, I want to start a better life, right? But how can you if you don't have the resources? So that's why I think a lot of people go back to their old ways because it was easier to make money that way. And then they wind up back, you know, and that's the cycle.
That's the cycle of recidivism, right?
Yeah.
It is high. And that's exactly what happens. You know, for me, I've always been successful and I believed in myself and I knew that, you know, God, if I can't sell myself and do something like this, you know, whatever it is I want to do. But it was a process to get there. You know, today I'm an interventionist. I'm a life recovery coach. I'm a public speaker. I do events. And, you know, I had a story to tell. I knew that. I wrote a book with my ex-wife, Addiction Rescue, The No BS Guide to Recovery. Hang on. I'll give a little plug there. Addiction Rescue. And, you know, it's like my story parallels the movie Wolf of Wall Street, you know?
Yeah. It does. I love that movie, by the way. That's a great one.
Those guys. We grew up together. So I knew them really well. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. What a connection that is. Yeah. You know, your story is very involved and, you know, I'm sure you have a lot of great stories attached to it, you know, when you were having these good times that you talked about earlier, you know, because, you know, I think in active addiction, if I can remember it, like I was telling my husband this the other day, it wasn't all bad. It's not like every moment of my life was dreadful when I was using. You know, I had, there are some really funny, crazy stories to tell from it. But at the end of the day, was I happy inside? Absolutely not, you know, right. And that's what the issue is. I don't remember who was saying this or someone I was talking to. It's like we in addiction and recovery, like you're not treating, it's not the drugs that need the attention. It's your mental health. It's what's going on with you that's causing you to want to go and use to numb pain. Like what's the trauma, you know, and that's what needs to be addressed. You know, the drugs are a side effect to trauma, I believe.
Oh, I completely listen. Centered at the roots of addiction. I've been sober a long time. And I see this all the time. Centered at the roots of addiction is trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma meaning, you know, not what's wrong with us. Trauma is what happened to us.
Yeah.
Right? A child doesn't get traumatized because they're hurt. They get traumatized because they live alone with that hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring it into adulthood. They've shut down for so long. You know, something happened as a child. Who did you talk to about it? No one.
Yeah.
Right? And we kept that. So in order to heal the addiction, we have to try and heal the trauma. But I don't know if we ever heal the trauma. We begin to process it. You know, the trauma, there'll always be, I still have that trauma.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, it never goes away. Yeah.
And how do we tap into the trauma? Through shame. Right? Something might happen. Someone might do something inevitably and say something, do something, and I revert into the, you know, I go into the shame place or the embarrassment, mm-hmm. which reverts me back.
Yeah.
So I get to revisit that.
So I have a question for you. This is something I'm struggling with, so I'm curious as to what your advice would be on this. But when it comes to self-forgiveness, you know, I'm struggling to forgive myself for going to jail. I can, you know, there's a gazillion things that have happened in my life that I'm able to forgive myself for, but for some reason I'm holding on to that and I can't. I mean, it's been 13 some years since I've been incarcerated. I've just been holding on to it. So what would your advice be for, like, forgiving yourself for something that happened like that, that was completely your fault? Like, nobody made me do that. Nobody made you do what you did. Like, how do you forgive yourself for that kind of stuff?
So I think the cut is extremely deep when you go through something like this, right?
Yeah.
We could, you know, inevitably put the Band-Aid on it. It could heal. The wound is always going to be there, but the scars are going to never go away, you know? Do we ever really forgive ourselves for something like that? We can forgive ourselves, but we don't forget, you know?
Yeah.
So how do you forgive yourself and say, listen, you're in a different place. I guarantee 13 years later, you would not have made the same mistake as you made back then.
Yeah, probably not.
Exactly. So you have to look at life and say, look how much you've grown from that incident. Look how much your life has changed. Look how much my life has changed. And sometimes, in order to see the growth, we have to go back to the time right before incarceration to where we're at today to see all this growth and wonderful things. And then I look at it, it's the same way I look at my drug and alcohol addiction, that my affliction is a gift from God. Going to prison saved my ass. Mm-hmm. I would have been dead. I had no question about it. Listen, I was completely out of control. The amount of drugs I'm doing and living a life, you know, that was just insane. And every given weekend, you know, where are we going this weekend? Vancouver. Let's go to Paris. Let's go to Vegas. You know?
Oh, geez.
It was nuts. And there is always going to be a piece of that shame in there and embarrassment. You know, I was sitting with a bunch of really successful people recently, and I'm just looking around the room and everyone's talking, and I'm just having these thoughts. Holy shit, do you think anyone else has ever even gone to jail yet? Prison?
Yeah.
You know? Wow, what an anomaly you are in this group. Like, oh my God. And it does affect us. You know, it's something that will, having that felony conviction is something that doesn't resonate really well.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you a quick story. When I got out,
yeah,
a few years after I'd been out, the federal judge that sentenced me had said at sentencing, you know, Mr. Mayor, I said something in my letter, my letter that I wrote to the court that day that I read, and said, someday, Your Honor, I'd love to have a cup of coffee with you. The federal judge has been set, that has been elected to the board by President H.W. Bush.
Wow.
Yeah, badass, you know. So years later, I wrote to his assistant and I said, you know, I'd love to have a cup of coffee that we talked about. So they wrote back and said, the judge would like to see you on this date between, you know, this time and this time. And I'm like, oh my God.
That's amazing.
Oh, I'm going to meet the judge in his chambers. I got to find the robe, right? What are you wearing in the judge's chamber? Oh no. And I went in there and, you know, we just chopped it up for an hour. I talked to him about the experience and what it was like. And, you know, he always said the prosecutor wanted 78 to 87 months and he went below the guidelines. He gave me 60 months. Mm. You know, he believed in me. And I had 50 letters of character recommendation from people all over the community, around the country that knew me and the good things that I had done. So he said to me when we're almost done, he says, you know, I'd like to use you as a resource for other people that are possibly going through this, that they could reach out and talk with you about this.
Wow.
Would you be okay? And I said, Your Honor, I'm going to tell you the same thing my lawyer told me at sentencing as we're walking in. He said, you're about to meet the man closest to God because this man has control of your future. I said, of course, Your Honor, you can use me as a resource. And he did. They called me at a few different, you know, instances.
That's awesome. What a way to come full circle. You know, he met you when you were at one of the lowest points of your life, and here you are. He's offering you an opportunity. You know, that's not something that happens every day, but that's because you when you sought it out, right? Like, it's not like the judge was going to reach out to you via email or call you a couple of years later, like, hey, do you remember me? Want to have that cup of coffee? Like, you took that initiative and made that happen. And that's something that a lot of people, you know, probably or would be afraid to do. I know I would be. Goodness. Like, just thinking about doing that, I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. Maybe I should do that. You know, but.
Yeah. He said I was the first person that he had sentenced that he's ever had coffee with.
Wow.
Met within his chambers.
That says a lot.
They also wrote that this is in no means a way that if something in the future happens, you could use this to get off.
It's like, but hey, I thought we were friends, so you're going to give me a light sentence, right? Or no sentence. That's what I remember hearing.
Well, we had coffee together. What are you doing, man?
That's funny. Then your life after prison, I mean, I know you said it was harder than going into prison. Like, what was it like building relationships with people, or did you reconnect with people that you had relationships with prior to being incarcerated, or did you kind of just completely start over from scratch with everything?
I still had some friends, you know, and I had got sober before I had went in again. I had been sober 12, 13 years. I was really active in AA and recovery. I had a sponsor. I sponsored men. I was, you know, now going back in there. And I knew that everybody knew, or at least I thought, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody knew what happened to me. And it was so hard to begin to start the process over. You know, my mind was so shut down to accepting that, you know, God, I could have been sober all these years. And these guys are standing up there talking about, you know, how long they're sober. And, you know, I had a lot of resistance towards going back and meeting people and wanting to befriend them. I just had that thought, God, they don't want to be my friends. Mm-hmm. You know, it was lonely, really isolated, withdrawn place.
Yeah.
But I did it. Did what I had to do. You know, how to kick down the doors of shame is by showing up. You know, shame binds itself by isolating and being alone. That's how we feed it. And I just kept showing up and doing things. And I didn't care, you know, that people knew or didn't know. It's too bad. You know, life is not about our successes and accomplishments, I believe. It's about overcoming adversity. And we all have adversity. And that's what makes our stories so special. You know, that we could shed this experience that we have to help other people through it. And your podcast could help other people that have gone through this that don't have the wherewithal to reach out for help and say, hey, oh man, I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm. That's such a great feeling, isn't it? Like when you know, especially like with, because we can relate to each other with what we've been through. Like when you meet someone who's been there too, it's like, whoa, you know, like I can't believe it. Like I've been living under a rock for over a decade and here all these people are, you and others that, you know, experienced a lot of the same things I have. And that's such a great feeling. And we all need to know that we're not alone, that we're not the only one, you know, because you can really believe that about yourself. You can, I know.
I call it PR we have, right? Prison radar. Right? Someone says you know something about it. It's like that instant bond that we could relate to, you know?
Yeah.
We know what they went through because we've lived it and lived through it.
Yeah.
And once you've that, I think it just resonates with other people so much easier that, you know, I work with a guy recently. I'm a life coach as well, and I do some coaching with a young guy, 27 years old, and he's like, yeah, I was in jail there. And then I gave him a copy of my book, and he calls me 2 days later. He goes, holy shit, you were in prison for that long? I never knew that. I said, yeah, I don't wear my black and white striped shirts anymore, so people wouldn't know.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and then how about, this is interesting, this segues into something else I was thinking about too, is like, you know, when people meet me and they find out my story, they're like, oh, I never would have thought that, like, you look like the girl next door or whatever, you know, thing they want to say, but like, you know, I feel like, how do you, like, I don't know how to react to that, you know, because it's like, well, what am I supposed to look like? You know what I mean? Like, what is because I don't look washed up, I couldn't have been through things. But then there's people who look bad who've not been through anything. Like, how can you judge someone or, you know, suspect something of someone just by looking at them? Like, I just think that's crazy. So I just had to say that.
I just don't listen. I clean up pretty good, you know. That wasn't obviously clean, but no, it's, you know, it's the stigma attached to that as well. What does a person who's been incarcerated look like? What does an alcoholic look like? You know, they think you have to be lying in the gutter drunk.
Yeah.
They don't realize that addiction is an equal opportunity destroyer.
Yeah.
And it affects us all. It doesn't matter our size, shape, race, religion, tax bracket. Right? And it's the same thing with incarceration. I was in there with judges, lawyers, chief of police.
Wow.
Drug cartel. 52 cops that were protecting the cartel in Puerto Rico. And the feds are tough. They have never seen snow. They sent them from Puerto Rico to Duluth, Minnesota to do their time.
Oh, God. That's messed up.
The coldest spot in the world.
Wow. Yeah.
Let me tell you, there were days that the wind was howling 40, 50 below up there. It was ridiculous. And you're going to the chow hall and there's so much snow blowing and there's older people and they would keep a rope outside the chow hall that you'd use as kind of a rope toe to hold on so people didn't fall over coming in.
But oh, I mean, my gosh. What?
Wow. The heat hardly worked. Maybe it got up to 50 degrees on a good night. You'd sleep in your thermals and sweats and a hat and gloves. And
That's horrible. It shouldn't be like that. Like, I get it. Like, jail is there for a reason. It has its purpose. But people shouldn't have to, like, live in those conditions just because they're incarcerated. Like, at least give you some heat, you know, or, like, you know, decent food. Like, the food, don't even get me started. I mean, I was in county, so I don't know what federal prison food was, but, man, it was bad. So
the trucks would come with the food. I swear to you, as the day is long. And there were signs on the back of the truck that said, not for human consumption. And we were dying. We'd see these trucks and we were like, oh my God, this is beyond anything. You know, the milk expired 2 weeks ago.
Oh,
and then, you know, it's just, they just don't care because they got a lot of donations of the food. And you know, that's why we just are blessed where we're at and we never want to go back there.
Yeah, never. Please. I couldn't. At my now, like that, I'm like in recovery and like moved forward with my life. Like, I couldn't imagine losing everything right now. Like, that is like, that's like one of the scariest things, though, I think. And once you've been there, I don't know about you, but I do have that fear in the back of my mind all the time. Like, am I going to go back? Like, if anything happens in my life, like something that is completely not criminal or whatever, like I have medical marijuana and I fear, oh no. What if I get caught with this? I'm going to go back. And it's like, Amanda, like, it's legal for you to have this. Like, calm down. You know, do you have that fear? Or get even getting pulled over. Like, if the cop lights come on, like, I go into panic.
Yeah, I see a cop behind me, and it's like my whole life flashes in front of it. You know, you don't think they got my attention. I stop at yellow lights today.
Yeah. Right? That's like, it's horrible.
I want to mess with the popo. I learned my lesson and I do the right thing today, you know, and I do. And I can't blame anybody. I blame myself. It's not their fault. They're doing their job.
Yeah.
You know, I was breaking the law and, you know, I paid the consequences attached to my action.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's part. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to talk over you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I said it didn't have to be that long. I could have learned. You know what, though? I saw people that did 6 months, 9 months, a year and a half, and came back.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, I got the right amount of time for me. For me, that's what I needed. You know, I needed a long time out. And, you know, in prison, it goes by football seasons, right? And I sat there and I go, oh, my gosh, I got to go do at least 3 football seasons in here. And so you just make the time and, you know, you look up and it's the end of the week already. And it's like, wow, another week passed. And then when you have your out date, that's like the worst. When they give you an out date, now you're counting down 106 days, 105 days. Oh, my God, this is insane.
Yeah, it's, you know how you mentioned like how weeks go by, like that's something, it was like a phenomenon for me. And when I was incarcerated, like I swear time went faster because it was like, all right, I'm in here, I accept it. And, you know, I created a routine for myself beyond the routine that's forced on you when you're incarcerated. But like I would read the Bible every night and it literally like, I'm like, whoa, like it's already the next month and the next month and the next month. And it's just, it's weird. Like it's, I think it's like some sort of, it's like a mind fuck. I don't know. I just felt like time was moving differently while I was in there than when I'm out. Weird.
I completely agree. You know, there's no outside distractions. Listen, yeah. We don't have any bills.
Yeah, that's you true. That was nice.
You don't have anyone, you know, saying, where were you last night? You're supposed to be here, you know, we don't have any outside distractions. So you're just focused on doing your thing. You know, which was basically working out, doing this, taking care of myself. You know, I met a father and son who owned a strip club in Chicago, and me and there was an old guy sitting with them. The first day I walked in, and they were playing cards, and I looked at them and I said, "What are you guys playing?" They said, "Gin Rummy." I said, "Hey, I'm David. Nice to meet you." And I sat down, and we played cards every day in there, and you know. Yes, we played for a little bit. I had my commissary taken care of probably the first 2 years. That's another story.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to make time go by. And we did it. And time flew. Mm-hmm. You know, flew.
It's weird. It's so weird. You know, and like, I don't know. That just like floored me. That was one of the things about it where I was like, wow, I almost felt like I had power over time. It was like, am I moving time? Like, is anyone else noticing like that it's already like January? Like, I don't know how we got here, but we did, you know, and that's true. Yeah, that was probably a huge part of it was there was no real outside, you know, distractions. Like there was no social media. There was no boyfriend. There was nothing. I mean, I had boyfriends while I was incarcerated, but like they weren't there to like, I didn't have any connection, you know, to anything other than where I was at. So it's crazy.
Yeah. And you look forward to the visit that you got, you know, so the week too fast.
Yeah.
You know, the hardest thing about the visits also that people don't realize is that my daughters would come up and after they left, I would watch them go out in the parking lot and drive off. And I'd go back in the fence, behind the fence. And I was like, wow. The first time that happened, it just hit me. Like, oh my God, what a feeling of being like total loser. Right? Can't even go home with my daughters, worrying about them driving 2.5 hours. You know, if anything happened, there's nothing I could do about it. I remember one day I was missing my daughter's graduation. I was in their high school graduation and I was just so pissed off. I went over to the chapel and was walking down there and I saw a guy there. He says, "What's the matter?" And I started telling him what's going on, shaking his head. He says, "I've been down 17 and a half years. My son was murdered. My daughter overdosed and died. And I lost my mom in here. And I had to watch it on video in the chapel."
Oh,
you know, the graduation isn't that bad. You know, that I'm missing.
And perspective.
It's like, yeah, it's the old saying, right? I thought I needed a new pair of shoes, and then I saw a man with no feet, right? It just puts it all in perspective, man. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, it's hard. That's devastating. Wow. You know, I can relate to you, too, because my son, when I was incarcerated, he was little. He wasn't, he was like 2 or 3. But I remember those moments of him leaving and just being like, I just want to go with him. And it's heart-wrenching, you know, and it's almost, I could say, debilitating, you know. It's just like, wow, like, I can't be there for him. Or, like, he would show up and his dad didn't change his diaper and I'd be like, he's full of pee. Like, I can't change his diaper. I can't, you know, I can't do, I'm completely helpless here, you know. And it's just, that's really hard. It's very hard.
The word that comes to mind is complete and utter powerlessness.
Yeah.
We have absolutely no power in there. And the thing about prison, they can take away our money. They can take away our freedom. They can take away our social. They can take away finances. They can take, and the one thing that you learn they can't take away from there, and the one thing that people have is respect. Mm. And if you disrespect a person in there, That's the only thing that they have left. They will fight.
Yeah.
You know, disrespect. So you have to learn different ways, you know, once you're in there. That's true. A lot of fights for people disrespecting other people.
Yeah, that's true too. When I was in the county, I remember there being fights, but I don't remember what they were about, but I'm sure it stems from that. Cause that's true. Now that you said that, that's very true. Like the respect, like if you disrespect me, like I made a mistake in there and, you know, this woman was very mad at me. It was money related. And, you know, I felt so bad, you know, cause I didn't realize, you know, the impact that had on that person. I just remember feeling like, again, helpless, because like, what can I do? Like, it's not like I can go out and like make money, you know, like there's nothing I could do, you know, and that's really hard. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah, you saw a lot of it, you know, you definitely saw a lot of it. Saw way too many bad instances, you know. I say I met a lot of really good people in there and I met a lot of really not so good people.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah, that's definitely a mixed bag. for sure. So on that note, like, did you experience anything absolutely crazy while you were incarcerated? Like, anything crazy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because in federal prison, they had, it was a low security prison, so there was cell phones brought in. Talk about the wild mania of stuff, you know. People have packages thrown, guys that are jumping the fence to go over and get this stuff and come in. I mean, it was beyond the wildest of my imagination, you know.
Wow.
How creative people were in there. But I saw some nasty fights, you know. Walked into the bathroom at 3 a.m. and saw, you know, 4 feet in the shower, and you just kind of just mind your own business and keep doing your thing.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, you saw a lot of stuff that you don't want to think about, but when you get out, you know, we were institutionalized. You know, if I heard keys clanging, I always turn around because I knew the CO's keys. Mm. That was the sound that they made. You know, the CO's are coming, or you know, whatever it might be, standing for count 4 times a day.
Right? Good old count.
Yeah. Wearing your shower shoes into your shower at home. I'm like, oh, I don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah. <know?
laughs> And those are the things that, you know, always knowing my surroundings. If I'm in a grocery store, I'm always looking. When I sit at a restaurant, I always put my back to the wall, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just stuff that you want to be aware of, because when you sat in the chow hall, you always wanted to make sure your back was in a certain way. You saw what was happening.
Yeah.
You didn't put. So just kind of stuff like that that resonated not so favorably on the outside.
Yeah, I mean that's true too. Like being institutionalized, you know, it's weird. Like when you're back into, you know, the real world, so to speak. You know, it's like everything. You just feel awkward, right? It's like you have all these things that you were so used to that were horrible because no one wants to be incarcerated. But when you get out, it's hard to like break those habits, right? And then you're like, wait a second, like, what am I doing? You know,
yeah.
So after you're out and everything, so what led you to do what you do now? Like, why did you decide to go that route?
I had done my first intervention probably 25 years ago. And I just loved it. I knew that I had a special knack of working with people, you know, basically selling hope to someone that's feeling hopeless and getting them to a place that they could recover.
Yeah.
And I started going to these events and networking events that I hated. People were just sitting there talking about how great they are and what wonderful things they're doing. And I just wanted to kill myself. I said, I cannot believe this is what I'm going to have to do. And I just started really working hard at it. I went to a bunch of different things and treatment centers. I met with people in treatment centers and, you know, had to play that game for a while until I just said, you know, fuck it. I'm going to just work for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do this. So much easier, you know. So it's the same way today. I say I eat what I kill, right? you know, I don't have anyone paying me anything. And if I'm going to make some more some months, and some months I won't. But you know what? My life is great today. It is. I have everything I want. All my needs are met. You know, I drive a nice car that I like. I drive, I play golf. I have great friends. And I created this life, you know, and I still take, you know, yesterday I was looking, I probably talked to 23 different people in recovery, looking for help, doing some things, you know. So my life is really full and rich today, which makes it a lot easier. But it's a lot of work to get there. You know, it took me 6 years to build it back up. And they usually say that your life doesn't change until you do the same amount of time on the outside as you were incarcerated, you know? So yeah, the first few years sucked. It was awful thinking like, you know, God, I'm not going to hit the lottery. So this is really going to be tough.
Yep.
I'm going to figure out what to do. And I remember what prison did, several things. And one thing it did importantly is it taught me the value of a dollar, which I needed. And I remember when I got out, I went to a grocery store and I spent $20 on something. And I looked at that $20 bill and I said, wow, my last month in prison, I made $19.87 a month.
Wow.
And like, spent it all in one thing. You know, I just blew it. And it kind of put it all in perspective. It really gave me the opportunity to appreciate a bed again, right? A pillow. Like a little things in life, so it kind of squashed me down, you know, down boy, you know, begin to realize the things that are really important in life. I lie down in my bed today and it's, you know, it might be, it was so much better than that little mat they gave me, right? Little pillow that was a rock that, oh God, I don't know what it was. It was stuffing. They put stuffing in these things and, you know, they sew it up and make a pillow.
Yeah, they're gross too. They're nasty. Very unsanitary. Wow. So you said you're an interventionalist, you're a life coach, and you wrote a book. Was there something else that you're doing now too? Am I missing anything?
I was doing a lot of public speaking before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And now the lights come back on. I'm hoping to do a lot more of that also. You know, I enjoy it. I love it. I get great reactions. I get these rave reviews, standing ovations, because my story is funny and it's sad, you know? And the places that I've been, I mean, God, I've been thrown out of two countries for buying drugs and doing wild things. And,
oh, geez.
I mean, I can't, yes, there's a lot of crazy, crazy parts of my story that actually a lot of it's in my book also.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I look at it, I'm blessed. Listen, I should have been dead a long time ago, right? And I say the two greatest days of our life, the day we're born, the day we realize why we're born. And when you're struggling with addiction and you find your purpose, your gift seems to illuminate. And it's like, yes, there's days that we struggle to say, am I doing the right thing? And I just know I'm on the right path, you know? And it's a happy path today.
That's amazing. So if someone wanted to connect with you, David, or get your book or find out more of your story, where could they find you?
So the book is Addiction Rescue, the No BS Guide to Recovery. It's on Amazon. It's on Book Baby. And my website is thelife recovery coach.com. The Life Recovery Coach is my website. My email is david@thelife recovery coach. I talk to everybody and anybody. You know, people say, I can't believe you answered. I said, well, you called my phone. What was I supposed to do?
That's awesome. Yeah, that is, you know, that's like a thing too. Like a lot of times, like you'll reach out to someone and you just never hear back. You know, it's like, okay, like I guess I'm not big enough for that person to notice me. And that says a lot that you take time to respond to people because not everybody does that.
Yeah, my girlfriend yells at me. She's like, you know, you're addicted to that damn phone. Do you have to answer every call? I said, I'm kind of OCD. I do. You know?
Yeah, there's that like me. It's like, oh, my phone went off. And like, I've gotten better at it, but I used to be like crazy obsessed. Like, oh, I have to respond right now because if I don't, they might think I'm not here and I'm here, you know, and I've gotten better with it over the years, but that used to be a huge compulsion of mine was I had to do it right now. I couldn't wait, you know?
Because how many people have I reached out to when I got out that never responded, never called me back, never text back, never responded to an email, you know? And I said, I don't want to be that person. I don't. That's not who I want to be. And, you know, to this day, I still reach out to some people on different organizations and they don't respond for 2 weeks. And what does that revert back to? The prison disrespect thing, you know? And if I saw them in person and they did that, my first thought would be to smack the shit out of them. The old, the new me, you know, we learned a little, lot of things, you know? I went from saying no shit to, oh, really? Oh, really? It's okay that you didn't respond.
Yeah. It's important, especially when it comes to someone like reaching out for help, you know, like if, you know, and then you don't get that response. And that could mean that person thought, what if some of that person reached out for help and then you don't respond for weeks or not at all? And that person ends up going back to using or whatever it is, you know, like we have to. I don't know, I'm not saying we have to immediately respond to people. Obviously, we all have lives, but to make an effort at least to try and respond to people.
So. Yeah, I've talked to people who had a bottle of Jack with Jack Daniels in one hand and a loaded gun in the other. You know, and saying, listen, I want to have the ball with 10 seconds left in the game. It's between them killing themselves and getting into recovery. And as an interventionist, being on the front line fighting addiction, that's what I do. I mean, I could see stories of people that I've been chasing and going, you know, wild, wild, crazy, resistant people who finally, after 6 hours, I let them cleanse out the anger, the frustration, the resentment, the fear. Because what lies below that? Submission and surrender. You know, I had a lady who was doing an intervention on a woman and she stood up the whole time like this, whole family sitting down in a circle. I'm not sitting down. And she kept looking at me going, F you, you know, to me. And I'm just laughing. And the family's like, why are you laughing? I said, let her get it out. She got to get the anger out, right? Too many facilities, treatment centers won't let you get the anger out. They want to subside it. If you get angry, you got to stop that or we're going to throw you out. No, let them recover. That's how we got to get it out.
Yeah, you have to get your emotions out or else you're never going to recover. Because if you're told when you're angry that, oh, we're going to kick you out or, oh, calm down or whatever, or give you like some sort of medication to calm you down, whatever it is, then you're still hiding your emotions. So how are you going to recover? Like, we have to feel our emotions. I tell people too, like, if you're angry and you're in a place where you can scream at the top of your lungs, because I know damn well I do, and it feels amazing. So you have to get it out, period.
Yeah, I completely agree. Get it out. I had a guy that went to the beach yesterday. He said, I stood there and I started screaming at the ocean. And I said, did you get it out? He goes, well, most of it. I said, well, go back today and get the rest out.
Yeah,
you know, that's really cathartic. You know, it's healthy shit that we got to do to move through this.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we let it all bottle up. We have to externalize it somehow.
Yeah.
There's not many people out there, I say, on the front line who know how to dispense the message on how do we dismember and dismantle the power of this obsession to get high. Right? When these thoughts come in, what are we doing with this? Are we just letting it resonate in our body and you know, we ruminate, we sensationalize, we romanticize. The next thing we know, we're doing things that we don't want to do, spending money that we don't have, hanging out with people we don't even like again.
Right.
Because, you know, as quick as it goes in one ear, I tell them, you got to get it out the other. I don't care if you use a mantra. Initially, I tell them to, you know, curse your disease. You know, I'm not playing with you. You can't play one-on-one alone. Go find someone else to play with. And they will. The disease will. It's going to go find the next person if it's not you right now.
Yeah.
But you got to be willing to do a couple of things, you know, and that's where change comes from.
Yeah, you got to want it. You know, that's the, you know, the first step in recovery is realizing that you want it, you know, because if you don't want it and you know, you go into treatment or whatever, like there, I mean, it could still work if you find that you want it while you're there, but if you don't, it's not going to work. It's just not. You have to realize it, accept it, and want that change, to want that recovery to happen. So.
Yeah, we took action that we didn't believe in and got results that were undeniable.
Yeah.
Right? When I got clean the first time, there was these two AA old-time farm guys up in Minnesota. And I never forget, one guy is taking the AA message, shoving it down my throat. The other guy is waiting there, making sure I digest it, pulling it out my ass. And then not leaving until I can, I learn how to become useful and purposeful and, you know, and learn how to pass this thing on. And today, I mean, it's served up on a silver platter, you know. Is this going to be okay if you want to do this? And this, no, this is what you need to do. This, we're going to succinctly show you how to pull your head out of your ass and rinse off.
I think that's what, you know, I think that's important because not, you know, all the like gentle approach to things is great for some, but for some people you need that like raw, real, like this is what it is. Either you do it or you don't, you know, like you have to want it bad enough. It's hard work. It's not easy to go into recovery and stay clean and sober. It's not. You know, and if anyone tells you it is, they're lying because it's not.
Right. So. Usually what we find is the most resistant people become the loudest voices of recovery, you know. And I kicked and screamed and I fought this thing and, you know, I helped create legislation in the state of Minnesota.
Wow.
I sat with a team in the Capitol in St. Paul, nine of us for, you know, a long time. Bringing the first opioid stewardship bill into this country. We had bipartisanship come together, Republican senators, Democratic senators, each with a mutual cause lost a son, a daughter, a loved one to an overdose. And we passed this bill and 12 other states took our lead. There was still opposition in the Senate, but that's another story of being funded by pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, just to be a part of that was just the most incredibly rewarding process.
I could imagine that being very rewarding. Wow, that's awesome.
Shaking the governor's hand when the bill's getting signed. I mean, that's...
Wow.
You know, it was fun. Fun stuff.
Wow. Wow, and I've also, so many things.
You know, I did these documentaries with the CDC on the opioid epidemic, and it's called the RX Awareness Campaign. And I just got an email a couple of weeks ago that last year, these documentaries won 6 international and national awards, and we won an Emmy for the documentary that I did with them.
Holy shit. Like,
you know, stuff like that. You know, I didn't sit in the guidance counselor's office at 17 years old and say, where do you see yourself in 40 years? I guarantee it wasn't making documentaries on opioids.
Right.
Stuff like that. But it's all good stuff that we're doing today. So,
yeah, and that's what you're put here to do, you know. That's, you know, I was going to say earlier too, like we're never given more than we can handle, right? So if you're going through something that feels heavy and you think you can't make it, like you can, because you were meant to go through that, even though it sucks and it hurts, but you had it was made to happen for you for a reason. You know, I do believe everything happens for a reason. I know that a lot of people don't think that, but I truly do. Like there's always a reason, always.
I do believe that, and I do believe. But what I don't believe is that we're sometimes people are given more than, you're never given more than you can handle. I look at these young women and children in Ukraine, right? The Jews in Auschwitz, right? They were given so much more than they could possibly. They didn't do anything. They woke up one day and they're getting bombed. They're getting taken, you know, they're getting shot and watching their loved ones. So.
Not really prepared for that conversation, but I get what you're saying.
Podcast with her,
yeah. But David, I really, really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your story and your advice with my audience. I just have the one last question that I ask everyone, and that's, what would be your number one tip for our listeners to allow the good things into their lives?
Practice, 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 right? You know, I have a saying, if you want to start feeling good about yourself, stop doing the things that make you feel bad, right? Mm-hmm. The simplicity of life is so easy. And it's kind of like, you know, you keep, when every time we use, I walk out that door and there's a guy with a baseball bat there. He's taking my head off. Every time I used to use, bam, It's a guy taking my head off. I went out the other door. That door was uncomfortable. People were playing chess, listening to classical music. And I was like, no. And I run. I kept going. And so as soon as you make the uncomfortable part of your life comfortable, life takes on a new meaning. It really transforms in ways we can't imagine. Sometimes we have to put ourselves into the uncomfortable to become comfortable.
Yeah, very true. Awesome. Well, thank you, David, again. I really appreciate you. And as a reminder to everyone listening, remember, you're stronger than you think, and you can have the life you imagine, regardless of your past. Make sure to hit that follow or subscribe button so you don't miss an episode of the show, and I will talk to you all soon.